Give me your hands to spread. Give me your hands to spread.
The year was 1954 when U.S. Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren dropped a bombshell on mandatory segregation of public schools. Speaking for the court, Warren concluded that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. For African Americans, the Brown decision was more than a mandate to desegregate public schools. It was the end of the Plessy v. Ferguson era of officially sanctioned American apartheid. Brown stoked the fires of the civil rights movement. Black people engaged in massive civic disobedience, serving notice that racism would no longer be tolerated. 50 years later, the struggle for educational equality continues. Students at University High School spent the past several months interviewing 11 people who have been touched by racism and have fought for fundamental rights and human dignity. Over the next hour, we'll hear their stories. This is In the Wake of Brown, Stories of Integration and Struggle. I'm Ruth Welch.
Give your hands to struggle.
Champaign-Urbana's desegregation battles began almost as soon as Justice Warren signed Brown v. the Board of Education. The Twin Cities had taken Plessy v. Ferguson to heart. Movie theaters, restaurants, stores, and grade schools were segregated. In 1954, there was a sustained effort on the part of local blacks to desegregate barbershops around the University of Illinois. That effort was successful, but for the most part, change in the Champaign-Urbana community was painfully slow.
There were very few African-American staff on this campus.
Yeah.
And I recall getting on the faculty bus and being told by the driver I couldn't ride the bus because since there were no African-American administrators here, I couldn't be an administrator. So I was advised to get off the bus.
At the time when the incident that I had on the bus, you know, now I think back, gosh, I could have been the next Rosa Parks, but, you know, because she refused to get up, and her situation was different. She just, you know, she had worked all day, and she refused to get up. The first seat she saw, she just sat down. Yeah, she knew it was wrong, but, you know, she still sat down. So I admire her quite a bit, too. I mean, this woman who just stood her ground, and sometimes I tend to think that's what I do. You know, if I know that I'm right, and regardless of what the situation or the circumstances are, I'm going to stand my ground, and people will tell you, I will fight to the end.
One of the first things that I wanted to do to make a contribution was to start an ambulance service because that was another area where when a black person got sick, the ambulance might come and they might not come. And if they came, they were going to treat you badly. So we thought, a few of my friends and I thought, there should be some kind of service like that in the black community that we could offer to the community so that our people could get their needs met that way. So I remember that because, first of all, we didn't do it, and I felt really bad because we couldn't seem to get that off the ground. But that sort of got me thinking in terms of what can I do to help the community.
Penny's opened up a new store, and I was a part of walking around the store, you know, people, whites were scared to go in there because they had all these blacks walking up and down the street there to keep them from going in Penny's because they refused to hire black people. Mm. So that was the first, you know, step as far as marching was concerned in this community. Was, you know, you're opening up stores, you're not hiring minorities, so we're going to march to keep them out, keep everybody out. And most people, there were some that crossed the line, but there were some blacks that crossed the line also. But for the most part, it was very effective. Penny started to hire minorities.
That was during the time of the civil rights era. So even in high school, for instance, I can remember as a 10th grader us picketing the JCPenney's store, which had just been built so that black people could be allowed to just be clerks in that store. And that was done we participated as students, but obviously it was the adults that had organized that, those kinds of activities. And we also did that same thing for a store in Urbana that was mistreating black people. Mm-hmm. So although I participated in those things, I still didn't necessarily make the connection between racial injustice and those things. It was just something where, from my perspective, it was bad people who weren't living right, and we needed to address that. So it became more of a, I became more aware, like I said, once I got into college as to what all that stuff meant.
I can see some things going backwards, because I think some whites really feel that minorities have taken their jobs, especially now since it's, you know, the economy's getting bad again. And I see that could be a problem as far as minorities being hired on jobs. I would like to see more blacks or minorities hired in better jobs, much better jobs.
I was in that group that picketed JCPenney's. And in picketing, I was spit on and called a nigger and pushed during that picketing. I was involved in W.T. Grant's, which was another store here, where that I was not allowed to sit at the counter and eat, even though I may have had money to pay for that food. But I was not allowed to sit at that corner. So I think when you're talking about segregation, it goes beyond just the educational part. Because I think to keep a person ignorant is to keep them up under your thumb. So I think education was a key to open up other doors for us.
Ain't gonna let nobody
turn me around.
Turn me around.
Yeah.
Turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody
turn me around.
We're gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, walking down freedom.
In the 1950s, Champaign-Urbana blacks attended segregated elementary schools, Lawhead and Willard in Champaign, and Hayes in Urbana. While Brown versus the Board of Education challenged Jim Crow laws, it would take years before schools in the Twin Cities integrated. When the school districts finally got around to enforcing Brown, their solution angered African-American parents. The age of forced busing began. Little did these black children know what awaited them when they got off the bus at Champaign and Urbana's all-white schools.
To be honest with you, the Brown versus the Board of Education ramifications didn't kick in Champaign for another 10 years. And really all people did was they closed all the black schools and made the black children attend white schools. They took all the best of the black teachers and put them in white schools. And to this day, as far as I'm concerned, that was not a positive move for our community. As a matter of fact, I think it's been a negative. Because especially on the elementary level, the elementary years are the years that you need to be nurtured. And in the environment that those students were put in, that wasn't happening. And that's really one of the reasons I ran for the school district board, because that legacy is still going on today, and that's what needs to be addressed.
I never saw pictures of people like me on the walls, or was I ever encouraged, you know, to even be able to identify with my own race within my school, because I never saw that. You know, I could walk into a school, and the only thing that I ever saw was white pictures. So did that tell me that I wanted to be like the white children? I wanted to have straight hair. I think if you look at that, when we were growing up, it was some sayings that went around that were not so nice saying, that if I'm white, you're right. If I'm brown, I can stick around. That was a mixture. When I'm yellow, I'm mellow. But when I was black, that meant I had to stay back. So some of the things that came out of those kind of saying was because it had been implanted.
I know that you attended Champaign High School, which is now Central, mm-hmm. and that you also attended Edison Middle School. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. So were these schools segregated or integrated while you were there?
Well, technically, they were integrated. We all were in the same building at the same time. But practically speaking, the black students stayed to themselves and the white students stayed to themselves. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't what I think Dr. King and other people had in mind when they talked about integration.
I don't think the teachers ever consciously taught you that you was different verbally. Mm-hmm. However, if I'm excluded from textbooks, that lets me know that I'm not part of the system. If things were not provided for me where that my culture was available, that meant that I was excluded from education.
Most students can remember their positive teachers, and most students can remember the ones that they really hated. And all the rest of them, after a while, they just become a blur. I must have learned something in these classes, but I don't even remember any of those people's names, to be honest with you. And I think that's not good. That again is part of the residue of racism. When you know that the teacher is only tolerating you, then you just disconnect, and that's it happens all too often, unfortunately.
I felt that there were some that treated us badly. They had different music. You know, the blacks had their music, and then what you encountered in the school was what we considered white music. You couldn't dance off of it and that kind of thing. But what happened was, over the years, we adjusted to it. It wasn't that, well, I'm not going to go to school because they don't have this, they don't have that. What you do is you adjust to it, because I found that a lot of whites were very nice to us. It was the majority were nice. It's just that a few that, you know, they weren't raised around blacks and their families weren't, and so there was that discrimination that went on there.
Growing up in Champaign, I think I might have had two black teachers in my entire educational life. All of my teachers were white. 80% of them were white women. So I remember a lot of the men, and they, you know, some of them were good and some of them. As a matter of fact, my favorite teacher was a man when I was in the 10th grade. He was a history teacher, and he was my teacher at this very year that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and I think we were actually in his class the hour after we heard the news about his assassination. His name was Mr. Wade, and I think Mr. Wade had a lot to do with me getting excited about history and looking into the background of things.
And you said that you were in Mr. Wade's class the hour after the president was assassinated?
After we heard of his assassination.
Did he talk to you about that at all?
Yeah, and that's what I liked about Mr. Wade. We talked about everything. He tried to help us with the racial justice issues as well. But I think the thing that I liked most about him is he treated all the children in the class the same. And so he looked at me as an individual and not as a black kid. And that's probably why I remember him.
So if he looked at you as an individual and you remember that, how would you say the rest of your teachers looked at you?
They looked at me as a black kid.
Uh-huh.
Well, maybe not the rest of them, but a lot of them. Because I can think of a couple of other examples of teachers who just came in and they saw it as their duty to teach you. And if you were willing to learn, then they were willing to teach. So there's nothing. They may have had prejudice, but it didn't come across in their attitude towards us as students. But, yeah, like I said, those teachers were few and far between in my educational life.
Teachers are just, they have a certain, they have favoritism towards some people, not just because of race. It could be because of grades. It could be because of religion. It could be because of attendance. You never know. But there's just some teachers who act differently towards other students, and I have felt this throughout my school career.
I encountered some of that, but for the most part, the kids were, you know, they were pretty friendly. Every now and then someone would say, "You nigger," or something like that. But for the most part, I had some friends that were white that I really thought a lot of. I discovered mostly discrimination in high school is when you go to the counseling office, and they steer the black students away from college. You know, well, if you don't have any money, you should find a job and you should take courses that will prepare you for employment, but not to go to continue on to get a degree. So it was a lot of discouragement. And I hear a lot of people that I know have said that that's what was happening, you know, back then. They weren't encouraged to go to school. So a lot of people got their degrees late in life.
I can remember being told to take home economics and those kind of courses because I was not college material. So to me, I was being treated differently because I was not afforded the same opportunities that other people would have. The other thing is like extracurricular activities that you guys were involved in. We were not given that opportunity where African Americans could be on the cheerleading team or even the basketball teams during that time. Later on in high school, we begin to see the integration of the sports, but prior to that, we did not.
So how did that make you feel that you didn't? They didn't want you to go to college.
Well, you know what? One of the things that it did, it hurt.
Yeah.
Because you look for teachers to be an encouragement to you. It hurt. It cut deep. You know, it's like a knife. It was really sharp. It cut into my spirit. But in the next vein, I looked at it like this. Who is he to tell me what I can do and can't do? And during that time, I was determined that I was going to do better. And then when I went to college and completed, then I said, oh, I was college material after all.
I've looked at data from studies that show with African-American children, when they come into the school system as kindergartners, they come in ready to learn. They may not have all, some of them may not have all the skills, but they have the desire to succeed. And by the third grade, that desire has been greatly diminished. And you can actually see, beginning at the third grade, where African-Americans, especially males, begin to separate themselves from the environment of the school. And I think part of the reason that happens is because of this race issue, the major part of why that happens is because of the race issue. But because nobody is explaining those things to them, they don't know what it is. They just begin to withdraw from things that are negative, from that negative experience, and then they start creating their own world.
We've had changes. You've got now where that your schools are integrated. You've got now where the textbooks have some African Americans in there. See, black history was never really taught in the, I can't say that when I went to school, the only person that I saw in my textbook was maybe George Washington Carver. But now if I look, you've got African American history that's being taught. I look here at Uni High when I was here the last time. One of the things that you all had was some short stories on black voices. Many African American kids have never experienced that, even with integration, that you're not really using the material to teach a child about what his heritage is. And if a child doesn't know where it came from, how can they know where they're headed?
Mama said, sticks and stones may break my bones, but child talk will never hurt me. Weeping her head, don't you know we've been took. Don't you know we've been misled?
We've been had, we've been
listening to In the Wake of Brown, Stories of Integration and Struggle. I'm Ruth Welch. Not only were Champaign and Urbana elementary children coming to grips with racism post-Brown versus the Board of Education, racism was equally prevalent at the college level. Blacks at the University of Illinois, professors, workers, and students alike, were ostracized. It would be the mid to late 1960s before the university initiated major desegregation efforts.
Keep in mind that it was a very intense time in our country. the Vietnam War. There were the assassinations of the Kennedys and King, and there were the Black Panthers were active, and there was just there was a riot in the streets. The National Guard was on our campus here. It was a very ugly time in many ways, a very bloody time, a very tense time. And we came here to integrate this campus, to or at least to open the campus up more during that time. So much of the tension that was in the country was on this campus. The year before I came here, and for the first 6 months I was here, there were over 100 riots in American cities. And the students we worked with came from Chicago, New York, East St. Louis, Philadelphia, Mississippi. So they brought with them a very highly politicized attitude, and they were very tense, they were very militant for the most part. And they came to this campus with all that energy and anger and frustration they had brought with them from the cities.
Did you ever feel you were treated differently because of your race? By teachers, students?
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. I, you know, again, sometimes retrospection is really necessary to understand the experience you just went through. So here's an example of those differences in treatment that I now realize was racially motivated, I truly believe. At the time that I entered the school, computers and internet and registering online, not a possibility. So you'd have to go to the armory, which was set up with all of these stations, and it was extremely hot, and you stood in line for hours to get registered for courses. And as I said, my mother and I were trying to figure out this system and negotiate this system without a lot of previous information. We just didn't know what we were doing. I knew I had to sign up for a full-time schedule. We figured out what that meant. I knew that I was interested in taking some psychology courses, and I found one that fit my schedule, and it happened to be a 400-level psychology course, which, of course, means it's for graduate students, minimally seniors. I was a first-semester freshman. I handed my ad list to a young woman who was assisting, and she was a student and realized there's a problem here. She's a first semester freshman signing up for a 400 level course, a graduate course. She turned to the professor next to her and explained the situation. And I recall him looking at me, and he had this sort of half smile on his face, and he said, "I think she'll be fine in that course." And I was allowed to sign up for that course. So I walked in my first day, and I was 18 years old. I was in a huge lecture hall with all of these seniors and graduate students. I was scared to death, and needless to say, I did very poorly in that class and didn't realize you can drop this class, Jan. There's a point at which you can drop this class and you'll be fine, and it's not a problem for you. So it was a really difficult lesson to learn. But I think any faculty any faculty member would know that an incoming freshman does not belong in a 400-level graduate course. Looking back on that now, I realize that, in my opinion, that had to have been racially motivated. Why would he do that? Why would he not take the time to explain what this means to these two people who are standing here clearly, as my mom would say, lost as balls in high grass?
I was in the payroll line, getting my paycheck once, and the cashier said, I can't find you. Give me your name again. I gave her my name, and she said, I'm sorry, but I can't find you. She was looking in the section for the custodians because she assumed that if I was black and had a check here, it must be among the custodians, and it was that sort of thing. In fact, I recall once, okay, let's take all night. I recall once again on an elevator going to the third floor to audit the students then. I thought I was responsible for foreign student affairs, among other things. And I recall This woman asked me, she said, do you know where is the office of foreign students? And she was talking very slowly. People think that if you talk slow, you're clearer. And she said, pardon me, sir, but where is the foreign student office? I said, it's on the fourth floor. And she said, my goodness, you speak English very well. Oh, and she began to talk real slow. Where did you learn to speak that way? I said, in Detroit. Detroit, where is that? It is in Michigan. Oh, well, congratulations. Have a good day. I said, thank you, ma'am.
When I first came to the University of Illinois, they came to the high school and took tests at the time. I was a stenographer, so I had to take a test in typing, and I also had to take a test in shorthand. Well, they came to the high school, and we took the test, and, of course, I got a very high score. So my first encounter with discrimination at the university employment was when I went to see, it was a gentleman by the name of Don Swift. He was in a wheelchair, and a very nice guy. He would send you out. So what he did was he sent me to the School of Music. And the guy that was supposed to interview me, I was told from the office that he was out of town and probably wouldn't be back for about 2 or 3 weeks. Well, I went back to Mr. Swift, and he sent me over to Admissions and Records. And it was there that I found that the guy that they said was out of town was not out of town. So that was a factor in the fact that he did not even want to interview me. And that was part of the problem with a lot of minorities during that time. You couldn't even get in for an interview if it was an office job. And I was called nigger on a daily basis. And it was worse than in the high school when I first went into Admissions and Records. It was terrible out here because blacks, they just weren't hired in the offices.
From door to door, standing here wondering which way to go.
African American parents and role models took on greater importance in the wake of Brown versus the Board of Education. Institutionalized racism and a lack of understanding of culture made it more difficult for black children to succeed among their white classmates. Those that did had strong family ties. Success wasn't just expected, it was demanded.
One of the things you heard the saying nowadays, it takes a village to raise a child. Back then we didn't know exactly what that meant, but it did take the community to do that. If you acted up, the whole community would get you. We'll take a switch to you and go tell your mother, and your mother and father would get you. And we would say a whipping, but a whipping was what you would probably call a spanky. And one of the phrases they may say, girl, I'm going to kill you. But I knew that they were not going to kill me. That was just terminology that was used within the community.
Try to teach my son that. Treat everybody the same. Treat everybody fair. Be nice. And what goes around comes around.
When I was little, they taught me the golden rule. Treat people how you want to be treated. And as I got older, they taught me different examples of that.
I know he had an experience or two with it. And as they came about, I would explain to him.
And they'd make me stronger by telling me some of their examples of how they faced racism.
That's part of growing. He's going to have to experience it. I don't want him to be naive to it, but yes, I am afraid. It's something learned. It's not something taught.
My father and mother both went to Champaign High as well, and they had experiences that were very similar to mine, which I found out later. But while I was growing up, I didn't know any of that. When we were growing up, all we were told is do what your teacher tells you to do. We didn't know that behind the scenes, our parents were going up to the school advocating on our behalf. Which helped a lot, but I didn't realize that was going on.
We may not have had a lot of material things, but we did have, I think, love and the unity in the community that was there. We used to have a big pear tree and a grape orchard, and it was the families would come together and they would pick those grapes, and all the kids would come and help make jelly, and they would make pear preserves from the pear trees. And that was a tradition where everybody pitched in with doing those kinds of things.
There's gonna be time in your life, things are going to go wrong. Don't worry about it. Hold on and be strong. Obey your mama and your daddy. That you'll grow up strong.
Combating racism, be it in Champaign-Urbana schools or the community, has often been a struggle. At times, racism has been subtle, making it more difficult to root out. Other times, it's institutionalized, making change difficult. Always, racism is painful.
In my neighborhood, I can remember two white families living in that area. But from what my parents had told me prior to that, it was a predominantly white area. But when African Americans began to move in, others began to move out. So it was a few that were still left in that area. But my neighbors and my friends were all black. One of the things that I remember being black and being poor, that the Salvation Army used to give toys and stuff to children. And they would come around on a truck. And on that truck, they would have like a brown handbag. And in that handbag, they would have toys down in that handbag. And it would be a white Santa that would be giving it out. I never saw a black Santa like they do now. And we still don't see a lot of that, so we could be reverting back to the 50s now. But one of the things that was in there was a white doll, even though they would come into the black neighborhoods to do that. And with my mother, I told her I wanted a doll, which was called an Amos and Andy doll at that time, which were black comedians. And I did get a black doll, which I really loved and cherished a lot. So those are things that, you know, I can remember keeping that doll till it dry rotted because it was like a rubber doll. But those are some of the things I remembered in my childhood.
At what point in your life would you say you started to realize that the segregation, it was really unfair and you didn't like it at all?
That's a good question, because I think innately, as a child, I always knew that there was something wrong. But I would have to say it wasn't until I was in high school, maybe the 10th or 11th grade, that I started relating that to my race. So I was an adolescent when those ideas first started ruminating in my head. And then they came to fruition once I got out of high school and went to college. That's really when I became socially conscious, or conscious of the social environments that had created the situations that I had lived in, and certainly most other people did too.
Used to go to shows on Sundays and stuff, and there were certain places you sit in, certain places you couldn't sit in the movie theater. And basically, they'd ask you to sit on one side or the other. You couldn't sit in the balcony, or you had to sit in the balcony, one of those kind of things, yeah. That's basically when we'd run into it, but that was kind of basically understood. But every now and then, we would challenge it, you know, to sit in, I think, what was one theater called the Park Theater. We weren't allowed to sit in the middle, and so we would sit there until they asked us to sit and move on the other side. So we just do that just for the heck of it. Didn't too much think about it at the time, but it makes you angry now as you sit back and reflect on it in later years.
All my life, I had heard stories about the police beating people. So it wasn't that I was scared. I just didn't want to put myself in that position where I'd be one of the people that got beat. So, but when we were stopped, we were actually, this is another one of those examples, because there weren't any restaurants in the neighborhood. In downtown Champaign, before the Illinois Terminal was built, very close by, there was a bus station there. And that was the only place that you could go to get something to eat, say like after 9 o'clock in the evening. So my friends, one of my friends and I and my cousin walked down to that place. Actually, it's kind of ironic because my cousin had just become a Christian and he was trying to convert my friend and I. And so we had this huge discussion going on at his house, and then we went and got something to eat and we're walking back. And that's when the police stopped us when we were walking back. So, you know, they were getting ready to arrest us, but something happened just for walking down the street, basically, because that's what we were talking about on the way back is we were noticing that there weren't any police around. And my friend had made a comment that the police in Champaign would stop you for having 10 toes rather than 11. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that we thought about. And then as soon as that came out of his mouth, then this police car drove up. And we did get stopped. So, but again, that kind of stuff, it just happened to everybody. There wasn't anybody that I knew that didn't have some kind of negative experience with the police. Now, we didn't get hurt. You know, they basically just stopped us and threatened to take us to jail, because I think my cousin at that point he might have been like 17 and we were 18. So they were going to take us to jail for harboring a minor or contributing to the delinquency of a minor, but you know, just anything that they could think of to harass you, they would do that.
Racism was not an issue with me until we moved to Champaign and we stayed in a predominantly white neighborhood, and that's where I experienced racism.
You had to make very quick decisions as to, Am I in the right place? Am I safe here? Am I welcome here? How will I be treated here? How will I be served here? Never, not knowing how the persons around you are going to respond to you. Mm-hmm. That is extremely problematic. It makes you very suspicious. It makes you angry. It upsets your chemical balance. You don't. You're always kind of walking on the sides of on your heels because you aren't quite sure what's going to happen. It's a strange feeling.
In my senior year of high school, this was right after we graduated. Our class was one of the largest classes at Champaign High School at that particular point in time, and we were the first class, I think, that actually had our graduation at the assembly hall. And so after the graduation, some white students who had also been concerned about racial relations had invited all of their classmates, including the black classmates, to the Champaign Country Club. And the Champaign Country Club was a place that black people never went, except if they were serving the food there or waiting on tables. So when we went there, we only stayed like 15 minutes at the most, because even though we had been invited, it was still pretty uncomfortable. And I remember this old white guy, one of the members, obviously. I can't even remember the comment that he made, but it had something to do with, we knew you all didn't belong here, or something like that. So, you know, that kind of stuff, I don't, you know, to this day, I don't know who that guy was. He couldn't have known us, but what he saw was a bunch of people who were in a place where they didn't have any business being. And that sort of typified the attitude of white Champaign residents towards black Champaign residents for all of my growing up years.
There was one point where I had missed a practice, and coach had gotten mad, but he put me in anyway. And I did not know the play that he had taught everybody. And he took me out, and everybody was asking, are you mad, are you mad, are you mad? He's like, no, he's black, he doesn't know anything.
My nephew, he's 16, and he's at Urbana High School. When he was probably in the first or second grade, he was over at our house, and my mom, he was talking about one of his friends, and I can't remember his name, and my mom says, well, now, is he black or white? And he says, I don't know, but when I go to school tomorrow, I'll ask him, you know, what color is. And I'm thinking, kids don't know. I mean, I think racism is learned. And that's why I always think that kids have a way of instilling things in their parents, too. Yes, you learn a lot of things from your parents. But as time goes on and situations and times change, you're able to mold your parents to a certain extent as well.
I think racism has the most profound effect on children when they're the youngest because they don't realize what's happening to them. I'd say the second most profound effect that racism has, a negative effect that racism has on young people is when they're in college, because then they do realize it and they do realize the depth of it, and that is not something that can be changed overnight. So probably those two age groups would, in that order, from my experience, I think are impacted the most. When you're in middle school and senior high school, you're so involved with studying your own navel, so to speak. Basically, you know, you're just trying to figure out who am I. So a lot of that racial tension is still there, but there are so many other things going on within you as a person that you don't really have a chance to think it through.
So you talk about your family. They were very supportive of education. How did they think about you maybe feeling kind of upset about or moving away from education because of the maybe racism or negative treatment you're receiving at school?
Well, to a certain degree, they had already gone through it themselves, so they understood it. But one of the other dynamics in dealing with racism is, even though you've been through it, it's hard to communicate to your child what it was that you experienced because you didn't really deal with it in the best way yourself, and so you don't really know what to tell your child. So our parents didn't really communicate a lot to us about that.
So they never told you about an experience they might have had as a child to maybe ready you for what you might be receiving?
No, they didn't.
Okay.
Some of that is more modern. Most of the time when in the black community, the way that people dealt with racism is just endured it and tried to get past it as best they could. But there wasn't this understanding, okay, here's what you can have to expect when you're coming through this world, and here's how you, as best as you can, insulate yourself from it. Now, my generation, we try to do that a little bit more. But even with us, I don't feel that I gave my children all that I could have given them in that regard either, because I was too busy out here fighting it. So, you know, they didn't really see that part. All they saw was the angst in many cases that I was dealing with.
People tend to define themselves sometimes by who they aren't, and sometimes we look for sort of obvious ways in which we are different, and certainly skin color would be obvious. But racism in America has this long, long history of, it's a legal history, it's a cultural history, it's a history that has defined these different physical characteristics as somehow reflecting real differences in character and in value. And when you devalue one group, that's a way of increasing your own value. And I think that's a major reason why racism persists. People have a vested interest in that.
Closest our brothers, we'd be the best of friends.
It's clear that much work still needs to be done before the ideals of Brown versus the Board of Education become a reality. But moving beyond racism remains a daunting task, one for which both society and the individual has responsibility.
I think what happened is that when you're in a situation, you adjust to it, and you never like it, but you do adjust to it, or think you adjust to it. I don't know if you ever adjust to being discriminated against, and that's the kind of adjustment I would never want to adjust to and accept.
Well, at that particular time, I really didn't think too much of it. being in junior high school, I probably should have, you know. But in recent years, when this came up again in the Supreme Court, then I thought a lot about it then. Are they going to make things go backwards? Or, you know, just what are they going to do? But, of course, they didn't. But
yeah.
I thought it was a good idea that passed. And to make the, you know, even though the students, I'm trying to see how do I want to say this. They wanted to be equal, but it took time to get things organized to become equal in the class. It's still not as equal as it should be today. Still a lot of work that needs to be done, but the law is there.
I just don't think we need to resort to violence at any means. And sometimes people say, well, sometimes, you know, it's unavoidable. Well, to me, you walk away. You know, then if something happens when you walk away, then that's on them. That's something that they have to pay for later in life. But just to me, I mean, there's got to be an easier way than violence.
A lot of the racism, a lot of the discrimination is a lot more camouflaged than it was back then. I think back then it was more people basically told you how they felt about you regardless of your race, creed, or religious beliefs. But now it's people still may believe that or may think negative, but it's camouflaged. And recognizing that there is a racial problem, not only in the Champaign-Urbana area, but it's everywhere. And in order to fix that problem or rectify that problem, you have to address that problem and then try to come up with some type of solution.
I generally subscribe to the idea of you know, thinking in the big picture, but acting in the individual situations that one is given. And I think that all of us need to, you know, be conscious of ways that we can combat racism in the small ways that we actually can, and in the individual interactions that we actually are, you know, involved in, even as we sort of try to hope for the sort of larger solving of the problem.
So what do you think can be done?
Honest dialogue, which is difficult. Building relationships that are based on trust and some sort of common larger purpose. I think those are the places to start, and I think they need to be in fairly small settings.
So what happened? Why is it that me growing up in a black school, black environment, being taught by black teachers that we could read and write and go on to college? And then I look at the kids now who are in integrated schools, and many of them are not. That's why we hear all the time about the achievement gap. Why is it such a big achievement gap between whites and African Americans? You know, I think a lot of that has to do with culture. When you're looking at teachers, many teachers, even now in where I work at, you find really don't care about African-American children. I can even, the way the schools of choice is set up, I've heard comments about, I'm not going to school with you all, and I hope you, a bad word, people, go back to being slaves again. Those things are coming out of people's mouths in 2003, as early as in the summer, that those kinds of things are being said.
Mm-hmm.
So have we really come a long, long way? I think we've come a ways, but we still are not where we need to be. I believe that it's necessary that if we see things that are not right, be it black, white, whatever the races may be, we as individuals must speak up and say, I am against people being treated this way. It would be all the same that if you were discriminated against because you had blonde hair and blue eyes. That does not make it right. When we look at the things that happened with the Holocaust and people were killed and those kinds of things. And we can even go back, we look at the things that happened to the Japanese here in the United States and Oriental families, how they were put in concentration camps during those times. So those are things that we as a people, as Americans, must always speak up against injustice, regardless of who that might be.
People everywhere, let's just show them that we care and unite.
And unite.
And unite.
Thank God
we're raising the gap.
You have been listening to In the Wake of Brown, Stories of Integration and Struggle, a documentary project of University Laboratory High School. We thank the individuals interviewed for this project: Hattie Polk, Willetta and Carletta Donaldson, Jan Carter Black, Clarence Shelley, Nathaniel Banks, Shamar and Lucretia Williams, Donald Robert Pearson Sr., Bill Sutton, and Terry Townsend. Project Director is University High Senior Kate Peisker. Production team members include Kinsey Cornell, Amelia Bro, and Bethany Hutchins. Special thanks goes to AM 580 producer Dave Dickey, University High History teacher Jenny Yee, and the 2008 sub-freshman class. If you would like to comment on this program, contact our listener comment line at 217-333-0853. That's 217-333-0853. Or you can email us at willamfm@uiuc.edu. That's willamfm@uiuc.edu. This production is also on the World Wide Web. Go to willl.uiuc.edu and click on AM, and then UniHigh explores the local legacy of Brown. This is Ruth Welch.